Dear God, we're thankful that we're able to be here together to share in our commonalities and our differences. We're thankful for the people who have worked so hard to put this symposium together and for the messages we've heard thus far. We pray now that we'll be able to learn more. Please bless Brother Quinn that he'll be able to present his messages he's planned. Please bless us all that we'll be able to travel back to our homes in safety and enjoy our stays here. These things we pray in the name of thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
He is probably without doubt. I was talking just an hour ago in the hot tub with Farrell Lines, and he says, who do you think are the most, who are the top, one of the most significant historians of the 20th century? And we said, Michael Quinn, without doubt. I remember the first article of his that I read. It was an article in BYU Studies about the flag of Zion that was unfurled on Ensign Peak and probably buried with Brigham Young. And it was a fun article. Michael's research has always been dealing with the out of the ordinary and the things that we don't deal with. His famous article in Dialogue that dealt with post-manifesto marriages, his article in BYU Studies that dealt with the succession to Joseph Smith, succession crisis to Joseph Smith, where he outlined four different versions of succession that Joseph set up in his life and how the only one that was operating at the time of his death was the 12, was a very important article. His articles provoke. They provide information that people have overlooked or have not seen in a particular light. And they require people to respond to them for years and years. He prompts continuous research. Everyone doesn't agree with Michael Quinn. People have had questions with his magic worldview books, with his hierarchy books, with his same-sex book. They don't like a lot of the nitty-gritty dirt details he reminded us of or told us for the first time about J. Reuben Clark. But people cannot ignore his books. They're good, solid research, and he presents facts that we have to deal with. In the same way that Mormon history never could be the same after Fawn Brody wrote No Man Knows My History, even those who hated her analysis and did not like her conclusion of Joseph Smith being a fraud, they had to deal with what she put forward, and she still has, by almost everyone's account, still written the best biography of Joseph Smith, however flawed it is. Michael Quinn is not nearly as flawed as Fawn Brody, yet the parallel is the same. People, Mormon history is never the same after Michael Quinn deals with a subject. You have to confront the facts that just hit you in the face. I've been reading the chronology in his latest volume, Volume 2 of the Mormon Hierarchy, the Extensions of Power series. And just as you read these instances of Brigham Young authorizing yet another murder, makes you have to reconsider what a rough and ready frontier culture our Mormon culture was, and you cannot, again, return to your view of Mormonism after you confront Michael Quinn's work. So, buy the books, read them, stretch your minds. As Joseph Smith said, the things of God are deep in port, and only time and experience and careful and ponderous and solemn thoughts can find them out. Thy mind, O man, if thou wilt lead a soul into salvation, must stretch as high as the utmost heavens and contemplate and search into and contemplate the lowest considerations of the darkest abyss. Thou must commune with God. Michael Quinn's work stretches our minds to the highest considerations of God and to the lowest considerations of humankind and their quest for God. And we'll turn the time over to him now. Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you, and I am quite taken back by the overwhelming introduction that Albert Peck gave. One thing that I must emphasize is that I didn't get to that point. Whether one considers it a high or a low, I think it depends on your point of view. without the help of many others, and Elbert is one of them. Editors of journals such as Dialogue and BYU Studies magazine such as Sunstone, who chose to put into print articles that I wrote. Publishers and editors of three major publishers, BYU Press, Sun Signature Books, and also University of Illinois Press, and also for a smaller work, University of Chicago Press, who made the decision that what I had written was worth their time in editing and working with me toward print. And if you talk to any of these people, from Elbert to the editors of Illinois Press or BYU Studies, you'll learn that I am not an easy person to work with as an author. And one of the most difficult things is that I'm always doing research and revising right up until the last book is bound. And I always consider a book or a publication as a work in progress. And for my editors, that has been one of their burdens. But they've been willing to work with me on that, and I've appreciated them. But in addition to editors like Elbert, who have put up with my odd ways as a writer, I also have to acknowledge mentors. And I have two Mormon mentors, Leonard Arrington and Davis Bitten, and two non-Mormon mentors, Howard Lamar and Jan Shipps, who have been very influential in encouraging me. And by saying this, I don't want to paint them as any way responsible for what I've done. I think those of you who know their own personalities and approach know that they are less prickly than I am in much of what I have written, and they are in some ways more conservative than I am in approach. In the history department, they pretty well defined me after I'd been there 1 year as being two steps to the left of Lenin. And depending again on your point of view, I am perceived by many as a radical. I don't regard myself in that way, but I have to acknowledge that is how some regard me. So I appreciate the interest that people have in the things I've written, but I do rest heavily dependent upon those who've been mentors and those who've been willing to publish and edit the things that I've written. Tonight, in talking with you, I will not be talking from notes, and as I've been thinking about what to say, that has been affected. My decision on that has been affected by the fact of a number of people coming up to me and said, I've read this, or I've read portions, or I have read all of the most recent book, Extensions of Power. And so I feel that I don't want to simply quote from or refer to things that are already in the book for those of you who have read it. And yet I know that many of you here have not read the most recent book and may not have read either one of the books that I've read written on the Mormon hierarchy. And so to the best I can, I want to provide something that will be new for each of those groups. So I think initially what I'll do is provide some background to how I got to this point that may provide some new insights or new perceptions on the part of those who have read the most recent book, which is this one, Extensions of Power, which, by the way, paged out at 1,400 pages last summer, and it couldn't be bound. And so the editors and I had to go through and respec everything, and that meant my going through and cutting out words at the end of lines so that it would reduce the number of lines, scalpeling my way through to make cuts in that manner. Also, the publishers reduced the type size, reduced margin size, reduced spaces between. So if you the size of this is about the size of Volume 1, but if you open it up and compare any of the appendices or even the chapters to the chapter in the first one, you'll think, boy, that's a big print book, that first one, because this is quite different in the appearance of the format of printing and those things that allowed us to squeeze 1,400 pages into about 950. I want to talk with you about how this came to be, and part of this idea of behind the scenes of the hierarchy involves my own interactions with them, which are not a part of the book. Occasionally I refer to some interviews that I'd like to expand that a little bit more to help you to appreciate how I did what I did and what it meant to me as I was doing it. Long before I was ever thinking of being a historian or ever publishing anything, I got interested in Mormon history as a manifestation of my faith in Mormonism and my participation as a Mormon. I learned, I don't remember how young I was, but I learned that through my mother's side of the family, I was a seventh-generation Mormon. Pioneer heritage was very important, and in California, where I grew up, we had Pioneer Day celebrations, and those were a part of my sense of who I was. And as I was about 16 years old, I began reading what was available in California in my ward library to me about Mormon history, which at that time was Joseph Fielding Smith's Essentials in Church History and B.H. Roberts' Comprehensive History of the Church, which covered the first century of Mormonism, and then it edited seven volumes of what was often called the Documentary History of the Church, but which covered primarily Joseph Smith's life. And that's what I read, and gained what understanding I could, and was fascinated by that story. But at the same time, I was having a personal interaction with general authorities, even though I lived out in the boonies of California. And really, I felt, as most of us, at least at that time, felt, that we were definitely in the mission field, and the true church was in Utah, and we were lucky to be a part of it in California. But I had, because of the peculiarity of our ward membership, I had opportunity to frequently see general authorities. Our bishop was a son-in-law of LeGrand Richards, and so frequently LeGrand Richards would come to our sacrament meeting. Sometimes he would speak, other times he would just be there and sit on the stand and greet people afterwards. One of my friends, that my same age that I grew up with, was a grandson of Hugh B. Brown, and his grandfather would come to our ward to visit his son and daughter and grandchildren. And so I had those associations, but not only seeing them at a distance. One of the more enjoyable and somewhat remarkable experiences was, as you probably experienced in growing up, those of you who grew up as Mormons, Mormons love to have dances on New Year's Eve, except when New Year's Eve falls on Sunday, and that creates a problem. And one of these Sunday New Year's Eves, we, of course, could not have an approved church dance. And so at that time I was 16, no, actually 17, and the bishop arranged for his father-in-law, LeGrand Richards, to be in a fireside with us on Sunday evening and talk with all of us who were 16 and up, as the priests, quorum, and the young women who were in the Laurels group at that time. So it was those of us who were 16 to 18 years of age, and we lived in a large ward, about 1,000 members. So it was a fair group of young people. And he talked about what it was like to be a mission president in the Netherlands in the early part of the 20th century, and he spoke with his great enthusiasm, and that was fine. But then after about, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, he finished speaking, and he said, well, any questions you have, you're perfectly free to ask. We have another hour or so before midnight, and he was determined to stay with us until the stroke of midnight as well. And so at that time, I had the opportunity to ask him two questions that I've been really concerned about because of my reading that year. One was the Adam God doctrine, and the other one was plural marriage after the manifesto. And I did. And he was quite remarkable. I didn't realize at the time how remarkable he was, but he told me on the Adam God doctrine, he said, Brigham Young taught a lot of things I don't believe in. And yet he said, I don't feel that I can judge them completely, and so I put them on the shelf. I don't understand them, and one day, perhaps not in this life, I will understand, but I don't feel that I can judge them in one way or another. And I thought, geez, that's an answer I could give to anybody. It was better than my answer when this group of same friends of mine went to a reorganized church service a few months before when we didn't have a sacrament meeting because it was the first Sunday of the month. The priest or the pastor at the reorganized service chatted us up afterwards about the Adam God doctrine, and I bore my testimony in the name of Jesus Christ that Judd Brigham taught anything so horrible. And he just shrugged and said, well, if you have access to a copy of the Journal of Discourses, Volume 1, page 51, I think, or 151, he said, you can read it. And he said, I have a photocopy of it. And I had a friend who did, in fact, have a copy in his father's library, and I read it and found out that it wasn't as easy to dismiss, especially in the name of Jesus Christ, as I had done. So I was pleased that President and Apostle Richards gave me another way of approaching that question. The idea of setting things on the shelf that you didn't understand without taking a position one way or the other, I found very appealing. And he gave me an answer about post-manifesto polygamy that came from his father's experience, and he talked about his father, who had been the replacement for the two apostles who were post-manifesto plural marriage, and his answer made sense. Years later, I found out it wasn't adequate, but at the time, it was an honest answer that dealt with his perception of a difficult period in Mormon history. But because of this approach, I felt that it was still appropriate, and I didn't feel any hesitation to continue probing these areas of difficulty in Mormon experience. And so by the next year, I was comparing the first edition of the Book of Mormon to the most recent edition and marking all the changes that occurred. And after I'd done that for, I don't know, about halfway through the Book of Mormon, I wrote Joseph Fielding Smith an answer, and I thought, well, I mean, he'll probably give me as good an answer from his perspective about this, and he knows more about it than LeGrand Richards. I got a different approach from Joseph Fielding Smith, who wrote me this letter and questioned my testimony about why I should be reading the Book of Mormon in the first edition, and he claimed it was the action of an unwise member of the church that had made this available, and it was one of the most regrettable things in the history of the church. And then he said, have you ever read the Book of Mormon in a letter? And if you have, why be disturbed about changes? Of course there have been changes, but they're not, they don't affect the truth of the book. Well, I mean, I was perfectly willing to believe that. That's the basis on which I'd ask the question. But I found that his approach to the question, or to a question, was not as open as that of LeGrand Richards. And so I began to recognize that there was a difference among men who I currently regarded as prophets, seers, and revelators in being asked questions about church history that might be difficult ones. Well, over the years, I continued in one circumstance or another to meet with the general authorities and to talk with them sometimes briefly when I asked them to autograph my copy of the scriptures. Other times I had opportunities to meet at length with them. And that included all the presidents of the church, from David O. McKay, who was the president when I was a teenager and began this quest, to Gordon B. Hinckley at present. Although with President Hinckley, I met him when he was an apostle in his home. With Howard W. Hunter, it was also prior to his being president. I met him and in his office for about an hour, and with Ezra Taft Benson it was not that long, but it was short, brief meetings that I had with him. One memorable one was where I was on the hot seat in his office meeting with him, Marky Peterson, and Boyd K. Packer all at the same time when I was a faculty member at BYU. But even though that was a pressured situation, ultimately I felt very positive about it. And my stake president's counselor, who had, was called in with me to be in this meeting, I commented afterward what a supportive, harmonious meeting I thought that was. After each one of them had in turn, they'd never asked me a direct question to avoid, I think, even the appearance of an inquisition. But each one of them, in turn, beginning in order of seniority, had expressed what a disaster they thought my public statements had been concerning the role of history, and commenting, as I had, about Elder Packer's views of history. And as we were leaving the church administration building, I commented to my former bishop, who is now a counselor in the stake presidency, what a wonderfully supportive meeting I thought that was, and how positive I thought it was. And he just looked at me and he shook his head and he says, "Never put me into this situation again. Never put me into that situation." Well, I did, actually. I kept doing what I did, but it wasn't for the point of sticking. And that's one of the misconceptions. I got this from people on the faculty when I was at BYU, who assumed that I was purposefully sticking it in the ribs of the, you choose your phrase, poking, the lion in the eye, whatever you want to think, that I was purposefully creating situations that would create problems and confrontations with the authorities of the church, and I wasn't. It was that I had maintained, and perhaps it is a childish faith, but I'd maintained my teenage faith that it was appropriate to examine these areas of inquiry, even if they were areas of controversy or sensitivity in the experience of the church, and that it could be faith-promoting, even if, like LeGrand Richards, I would have to put or ask the readers to put things on the shelf. It would be something that ultimately was of benefit to do, and that the process of inquiry itself was a good process, even a spiritually healthy process. Well, in the process of this, I finally decided that my hobby of history was too compelling to remain a hobby. And when I came out of the military after 3 years, I decided to give up my plans of going on to English literature for a PhD, and I switched to history. And at that point, I had only taken one elective course in history as an undergraduate. My majors had been English and philosophy, and history had always been a hobby, and that's what I had thought it would remain. But I was too obsessed with history for it to remain that way. Well, in my first year at BYU, or pardon me, at the University of Utah, I took a course taught by Davis Bitton on historical methods. And that was one term, and then the second term, we were to choose one of those methods and write a long paper, about 50 pages, using one of those methods of history that we had studied in the first term. And one of the methods that I'd never heard of before, I studied it, was group biography. And in that method, you approach a group that has some kind of cohesive identity. Could usually leadership groups, but not always, just a group of people who have a sense of self-identity. And then you look at that group as if it were an individual and ask all the questions that you do about an individual in a biography. And I decided that's the approach I wanted to use. And I ended up choosing the leadership of the Mormon Church, the general authorities, as the group. And it grew from there. It started out as a seminar paper. It eventually became a master's thesis at the U. I went to Yale. And I must say the only reason I got into Yale was that Leonard Arrington got me into Yale. I was originally turned down. and the Leonard just had written, or after he learned I'd been turned down, he wrote a letter of inquiry to know why, and his own stature was so great that the dean of the graduate school phoned Leonard on a Saturday to explain why, and the upshot of their hour and a half conversation was that Yale offered me a half tuition fellowship if I would be willing to take loans for the balance, which I had indicated that I would not be able to come to Yale without financial aid. And so Leonard was the one who got me into Yale. And so Leonard is not only my mentor, he has also been a far more significant person in my academic life than simply that of mentor. And when I say simply, I don't mean to diminish the role of mentor. But Leonard has been a tremendously influential person in my life, even though I am more radical than he is. Anyway, it became a PhD dissertation, and initially I thought that by limiting my study to the first century of Mormonism, I could avoid real problems. I found later that wasn't the case, but I thought that if I could limit it to the men who served as general authority up to 1932, that would be safer. And I had no intention of ever dealing with somebody who was alive during my own lifetime. And during the early years of my study, that's where all of my work went, is in that first century. But then I got an assignment at BYU under the presidency of Dallin H. Oaks to do a biography with university approval of J. Reuben Clark, which pushed me down to my own lifetime. I mean, I remembered as a young person in California watching the closed-circuit TV broadcast of conference and hearing J. Reuben Clark speak. And this was far closer to my own circumstance than I'd ever expected to be doing research, but that happened. And over time, ended up interviewing people, having associations where I learned far more than I had ever expected that I would about contemporary Mormonism. In other words, Mormonism that overlapped with my own lifetime. And so as I finally, after all the years I was working on it, began talking with the publisher who had agreed to publish the study, Signature Press, about the coverage of the book, gradually I began to see that limiting it to the 1832 to 1932 period would be far less than I knew, far less than my own research had covered. And so I decided to bring it up to the present, at least to the time of publication. And this book brings it up to November 1996. And I tried to cover areas that I felt would be significant to readers. And yet I also felt that there was a problem in focusing on the hierarchy as I had, and yet not looking at the entire culture. And yet I couldn't do everything I wanted to do. And I really felt tremendous frustration that so much, for example, of my study was male-based, which when you're looking at a leadership group that's limited to males, that's fairly difficult to include females, except when you're talking about family and marriage, which I did, but that still brought women into the equation of discussion only in one chapter. And I felt a lot of frustration about how the direction of my research had excluded so many things that I thought were important in the Mormon experience. Well, the final resolution to that, the best compromise I could come up with, was to include a chronology that would, for the most part, not have any commentary by me about why I thought a certain date and a certain event was important, but would simply list dates, events, quotations that I thought were of significance in helping to flesh out the reader's image of what Mormon society, Mormon culture, Mormon theology, Mormon leadership below the general level was like. And so that became something that I began working on in 1988 after I left BYU, and I worked on it for 8 years. And the 150-page chronology that covers 1848 to 1996 is the product of that. And it doesn't adequately discuss any of those areas, but it does suggest to the reader that there is a larger world here than simply the leadership of the church. And to the best I could, I also tried to show that there was a larger world than Salt Lake City, a larger world than Western United States, a larger world of Mormonism than North America. Inadequate, yeah, but at least it provided an antidote to the highly focused discussion throughout the study on the leadership of the church at headquarters. Okay, with that kind of discussion, I'll talk a bit about this question of decision-making in the leadership of the church and give some examples of it. One of the things that is unique about the leadership of the LDS Church is the requirement for unanimous votes. That is certainly not true throughout most other, that I'm aware of, any other decision-making group in the United States. And it tends not to be the pattern throughout the world, although somebody pointed out an example in Japan where this is required. But it's certainly not a part of the culture in which the Mormon hierarchy operates in North America. And this creates a particular challenge for these men who accept positions in the Mormon hierarchy, because there is no paid ministry. These men have come out of various private endeavors in life in which, for the most part, they filled an executive role. So that just prior to becoming a general authority, these men were accustomed to being the final deciding factor in decision making. That the buck stopped with them, whether it was in a business or whether it was in education, if they were a professor or if they were a university administrator. Very often they were near the top in that university administration. And suddenly they're thrust into a decision-making role where they're no longer the final word. And instead they have to come to an agreement with a group of 12 other individuals, or 11 other individuals if they're in the quorum of the 12, who have widely different points of view and experiences, and age. There's an age range difference, generational in some cases, and that creates particular kinds of challenges. Because there is a revealed requirement of unanimity, this eases decision-making in the sense that before a decision, everyone is prepared for the fact that it has to be unanimous. And a unanimous negative decision can be, and is, as valid as a unanimous positive decision. So the requirement predisposes the men in decision-making to look for areas of agreement, to look for consensus as they're commenting about a matter that may come before them. That's very helpful. The problem in decision-making at this level has come when there have been conscientious differences about what is the right course to take. When the alternatives do not seem subject to an easy reconciliation and a unanimous vote. And then the question comes, how does the hierarchy deal with dissent within the hierarchy? We're more accustomed to thinking of it, how do they deal with dissent from us when we feel or express dissent? But the hierarchy has, from the 1830s to the present, had to deal with a more fundamental issue, and that is, how do they deal with their own internal dissent? When it's not simply frivolous, when it is not and cannot be dismissed either as frivolous or as unrighteous, but where it's based in fundamental differences of conscience about what is the right thing, what is the best thing for the people of God, what would God want us to do, and you have different points of view on what that is. And how does a presiding officer, say of a quorum of the 12, deal with that kind of division when you have either down the middle division of view, or when you have one person who feels so strongly that the consensus of the rest of the 12 is not what God would want them to do. And how is that individual supposed to reconcile his conscientious dissent from the consensus of the rest of the quorum and decision making? So that's what the book in the first four chapters looks at, is this issue of conscientious dissent, sometimes increased by personality disputes. And I think in our own lives we know that it's one thing to have a disagreement with somebody who you feel a personal kinship with. It's quite something else to have a disagreement of attitude or philosophy with somebody that you already are irritated by. and if, you know, that heightens the whole issue, because then personality becomes wrapped up with matters of conscience. And that has happened in the hierarchy as well. And when I use the term hierarchy, I'm not using it in any way to denigrate the presiding quorums. This is a term that the secretary in the first presidency, Francis Gibbons, has frequently used in his description of the presiding quorums. It's just a shorthand version of saying the presiding quorums of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Well, what are the kinds of disputes that can occur? Well, they're not, when they do occur, they're generally not over minor matters. And I'll give you some examples. The question of whether the Quorum of the Twelve should organize the First Presidency is, in for those within the Mormon framework who have seen a death of a president and the choosing of a new president, that is not a matter of small consequence. And it's generally well known, I think, that in the 19th century there were long periods of time when there was no organized First Presidency, when the Quorum of the Twelve as a group constituted the leadership of the church. This occurred for a period of 3.5 years after the death of Joseph Smith. It's kind of an easy way to describe it. 2.5 years after the death of Brigham Young, and 1.5 years after the death of John Taylor. And those periods of time, typically in most of the traditional histories of the church, such as Joseph Fielding Smith's Essentials in Church History, those periods of time have been presented as, oh yeah, well, it took them that long, or the Lord wasn't ready to organize the church, or they didn't feel it was necessary to do that, or maybe just simply saying, without any kind of offered explanation, the president of the church died on this date, and the Quorum of the Twelve did not organize a new First Presidency until such and such another date. Well, there's far more behind the scenes than that, and it was a fairly standard reason in each of those cases. The reason was that the Quorum of the Twelve had been accustomed to the priorities, the prestige of leading the church as a group. And the Quorum of the Twelve did not want to surrender that to a group of three apostles, or the senior apostle with two counselors, who would now become the highest administrative body of the church. The Quorum of the Twelve did not want to surrender that, and particularly did not want to when there had been a pattern in the past that when there was an organized presidency of three, that organized presidency of three diminished the administrative role of the president or of the Quorum of the Twelve. And so it essentially was a jurisdictional dispute that prevented the First Presidency from being organized for a period of years and after the death of those three presidents. And it was not simply happenstance. And it was not simply that the idea wasn't proffered. In fact, the senior president repeatedly, in each case, asked the Quorum of the Twelve to organize the First Presidency, and repeatedly the Quorum of the Twelve voted down the motion or expressed such opposition that rather than putting it to the vote, the presiding officer whether it was Brigham Young or John Taylor or Wolfowitz Woodruff, withdrew the motion because he knew that the quorum was not going to unanimously vote for it. And so that's one example in the 19th century. Another example in the 20th century was a 10-year standoff over the appointment of a general officer of the church, the presiding patriarch, or as often called, the patriarch to the church. In 1932, the patriarch died. His son, Eldred G. Smith, was available for patrilineal succession. He was a worthy member of the church. His father had told him and had expressed to others that it was his hope that his son would be his successor. And after considering the alternatives for a period of time, the Quorum of the Twelve unanimously recommended in a formal written format in March 1933 that the new patriarch to the church be Eldred G. Smith, who was the son of the former patriarch. However, Heber J. Grant, the previous year, had indicated that he wanted his son-in-law, who was a member of the Smith family, but not in the line of the former patriarch, to be the new patriarch. And he would not accept the unanimous recommendation of the Quorum of the Twelve, and the Twelve said, well, then make another recommendation and we'll sustain it. And President Grant said, I cannot recommend my own son-in-law. That recommendation must come from you. And the Twelve said, we're not going to, we've made our recommendation. If you want to set it aside, do so, and we will vote on your motion, but we will not recommend your son-in-law. And there it stood. Every conference for 9 more years, they would bring up the issue again, and neither side would budge. And it wasn't until the late summer of 1942 that both groups moved toward the center. And in decision-making, this is the art of decision-making, where there is a conscientious difference of view, is that compromise is what's necessary. And the Quorum of the Twelve, under the leadership of one of the apostles, was moved toward not being so adamant in its proposal for Elder G. Smith. And President Grant gave up his hope for his son-in-law and instead recommended another man, Joseph F. Smith, who was born in 1901, who was also the son of a former member of the Quorum of the Twelve, Hiram M. Smith. And both sides moved toward a center ground. And as a result of that, and also of meeting privately with each of the 12 to make sure that he had a unanimous acceptance of those who were present before he presented the formal motion, Heber J. Grant presented, for the first time, a new nominee, Joseph F. Smith, who was born in, not the president of the church, but who was the grandson of that president by that name. And the Quorum of the Twelve accepted that nomination. But it had taken 10 years. And a general authority office was vacant for 10 years. That is not a matter, I think, of small moment. And it represents a division of point of view of what, and essentially it comes down to the question is, what does God want? And the Quorum of the Twelve decided God wanted this man. And Heber J. Grant was convinced God wants this man. And I want him. I love him. He's my son-in-law. And neither group could accept what the other perceived as the will of God for the church. And so things didn't change for 10 years. Another example, and I want to give a lot of time for Q&A, so you're going to have a lot of time, and if you don't have Q&A, then you're going to go home for early. But I'll give you a couple of other examples that may take probably no more than 15 minutes at the most. And that relates to, I'll give you an example before that, two of the most powerful changes in Mormon policy, which also were perceived at the time as being changes in Mormon doctrine, also involved a split of view. The first is polygamy. For decades before 1890, Wolfowitz Woodruff and a number of other apostles and presidents of the church had said, published in sermons, had published in editorials in the church news and rather in the church newspaper, the Deseret News, that it was impossible to end the practice of plural marriage, that God would never allow it, and that if the saints were to do it, then God would take the priesthood from them and give the priesthood and plural marriage to another people, that it would be impossible to give up the practice of plural marriage. The federal government, on its part, argued, if we allow the practice of plural marriage among this minority of people, that will destroy marriage everywhere in the United States. And this is a theme that you find repeated as well today, and it's an exact carryover in the argument against same-sex marriages, that if you allow an alternative form of marriage that threatens the 90% majority form of marriage. And Mormons in the late 19th century said, this is ridiculous, that argument. Our marriages that we perform conscientiously and we live conscientiously are not a threat to monogamy in Boston or in Philadelphia or in Washington, D.C. But they underestimated the real hysteria. And when I say the argument is the same, the hysteria is equally real, equally sincere today on the part of those who use the argument against an alternative minority marital practice. The majority of Americans sincerely believed that to allow polygamy among the very few, relatively few Mormons who practiced it, was a threat, in fact, to monogamy in Boston, in Philadelphia, in Washington. And so their argument was, we cannot allow Mormon polygamy to continue, otherwise our civilization is doomed. So here you have two irreconcilable points of view about this one issue, practice of plural marriage, both of them expressed in doomsday terms. If we give it up, we're lost. God will abandon us. If we allow it to continue, American civilization is lost. It will degenerate into the lowest form of human association possible. The family will cease to exist. And there you have those two arguments. Well, who had the power? The power was held by the argument of annihilation. And so the government basically said, we're not going to allow our society to be annihilated or our marriage practices to be annihilated. We're willing to annihilate you as a society if necessary to stop polygamy. And so in 1890, the president of the church did, in fact, face the annihilation of the church and of the Mormon people as a people, including their loss of all citizenship rights within the United States, merely because of the practice of polygamy. So he did what he himself had preached for decades was impossible. He abandoned the practice of plural marriage. How did he do it? Well, I need to step back a bit. You have to remember that the Quorum of the Twelve had refused for a year and a half to accept his recommendations for organizing a first presidency. He had known what it was like to meet the opposition of the Quorum of the Twelve and not be able to make a decision. A year before the manifesto, he had presented a document very similar to that to the Quorum of the Twelve, which he said had been written in Washington, D.C. Whether it was or not, I don't know. But he presented it to them for their consideration, and they were, to a man, outraged that anyone could think of imposing this on the Mormon people or expecting them, as leaders of the church, to accept it. Wilford Woodruff knew that he had a group of very strong-willed men who had not been at all hesitant to oppose him on organizing the first presidency and had made it very clear less than a year before that they would not support a public retraction of the practice of plural marriage. So what did he do? When the federal officers made it clear that they were going to confiscate the temples, for him that was the end of the world. Nothing was more important to Wilford Woodruff than the temples. And he went with his counselor to San Francisco, met with prominent leaders of the California Republican Party and National Republican Party, including the former permanent chair of the previous Republican Party convention, and asked what they should do, what should happen. And they said, you have to give up polygamy. You have to. And if you do, we will do everything in our power to protect you and to bring about statehood for Utah, which had been this long-sought goal of Mormon leadership. Wolfwood Woodruff came back. It was the middle of the week. All of the apostles, all but three, were out of Utah on conference assignments to stakes hundreds of miles away. And he called the three apostles, two of whom had supported him in the previous battle between him and the first presidency over the Quorum of the Twelve, one of whom had opposed him but believed that the Second Coming was going to happen in 1891 and had been preaching that for 6 years and wouldn't be expected to oppose something like temporary giving up of polygamy in 1890 since the Second Coming was going to happen in 1891. And three members of the Quorum of the Twelve were all he consulted. And the other nine members of the Quorum of the Twelve read about the manifesto in the newspapers, and they were outraged. And it's very clear what would have happened. In counterfactual history is sometimes given a bad reputation because it is moving against what did happen. But in this case, it's very clear what would have happened, because when the Quorum of the Twelve met for 2 days after the manifesto had been publicly sent to all the newspapers throughout the United States, and you have the president of the church saying, it is now my advice to the Latter-day Saints to obey the laws of the land concerning marriage. When the Quorum of the Twelve discussed that, after it was already an accomplished fact, almost to an individual, they indicated they opposed it. And they did not like it. And they thought it was a violation of revelations given to Joseph Smith, to John Taylor, and to Wolfwood Woodruff himself, just the year before, where Wolfwood Woodruff had received a revelation after they had opposed that Washington, D.C. draft manifesto, quote-unquote. And in that revelation to Wolfwood Woodruff, God said, don't make any promises to the leaders of the country. And the Quorum of the Twelve said, what does this mean? But they were faced with a fact. The fact is that in their absence, this had been done. And so what do they do now? And they did the inevitable. And that was, grudgingly, they voted to sustain the quorum, or rather the first presidency, specifically Wolfwood Woodruff's issuing of the manifesto. However, some of the apostles refused to vote when it was presented at the public conference in October 1890. Another example of conscientious, this isn't frivolous, conscientious disagreement within the highest councils about what is God's will, what is the best for the people of God. Then the next most dramatic change in policy / doctrine, the role of the LDS Church since 1852 of denying priesthood ordination to those of Black African ancestry. The situation in 1969 was this. David O. McKay was mentally incapacitated, and I talk about this in the book. His counselors were two known liberals who were also uncle and nephew. The senior counselor was Hugh B. Brown, who had been on record privately and publicly as saying that the priesthood ban against those of African American descent was non-scriptural, was non-revelatory, was an embarrassment, and had to be changed, and would be changed. In that period of late 1969, BYU was in the beginning of a series of sports protests over this discriminatory policy as it affected the athletic teams of BYU. And Stanford University was on the verge of refusing and withdrawing from the Western Athletic Conference and refusing to participate with Brigham Young University because of this question of racial bias, which Stanford defined as a civil rights issue, not simply a doctrinal issue that affected members of the church only. Hugh B. Brown succeeded in getting the Quorum of the Twelve to endorse a statement which he and his fellow counselor and they would jointly issue ending the ban. The problem was twofold. One, the president of the church was not mentally aware of what was going on. That's one problem. The other problem was that one of the most powerful members of the Quorum of the Twelve just happened not to be around when this decision was made. Harold B. Lee, who not only was powerful, but who not also supported the priesthood ban and was a social conservative who was on record in favor of segregation, including BYU. And when he came back and learned about this decision, he was not amused, and he, by whatever means, whether it took more than just a simple motion, he persuaded the Quorum of the Twelve to reverse its decision. And he came to Hugh B. Brown in that period of late 1969, and not only had reversed the decision, but brought to him a document which had been produced by a committee of general authorities, including Neil Maxwell and Gordon B. Hinckley, and this document reaffirmed the very thing that Hugh B. Brown thought he had reversed. And Hugh B. Brown reluctantly signed this document because not only for two reasons. He was ill. He had was facing now the unified opposition of the Quorum of the Twelve instead of their support. And Harold B. Lee made a very telling administrative argument. He said, how can you make a decision of this importance when the president of the church is incapacitated? How can you? You have no right to do that. And so Hugh B. Brown signed the document, and it was circulated to members of the First Presidency, general authorities, and local leadership throughout the United States. However, as I state in the book, he did not go quietly into the night in that loss. He was very unhappy about it and told a San Francisco newspaper reporter that the change in priesthood would occur in the short future. And when Harold B. Lee read that in the newspapers, he was furious and said, which was not an exaggeration, he said, Hugh B. Brown has been talking too much. Well, Hugh B. Brown wasn't finished, because within days, a newspaper report appeared that not only was the rumor going to be that the change would occur eventually, but that Harold B. Lee was responsible for this reaffirmation. It didn't say who the source was. It was on deep background, but I don't think we need to look very far to guess who had told the newspapers that Harold B. Lee was responsible for that document. Well, that's where the situation was in January of 1970 when David O. McKay died, a few days after the publication in the newspapers of this reaffirmation of the priesthood ban. Very interestingly, the president of the NAACP, Roy Wilkins, wrote an editorial in the Los Angeles Times and said, the walls on race in Mormonism will come crumbling down in the very near future. And 8 years later, that's what happened. And it happened because another president of the church, equally convinced that it was in the best interests of the people of God on earth, and it was the will of God for there to be a monumental change, just as Wilford Woodruff had felt that in 1890. And the manner in which Spencer W. Kimball changed is quite extraordinary, in that he did not tell either his counselors or the Quorum of the Twelve that he had concluded to end the priesthood ban. He confided one person, a person of black African ancestry, Helvetio Martins in Brazil, a Brazilian black, who he told him that he should prepare himself to receive the priesthood in the not-too-distant future. And for almost a year, Brazilian Black and Spencer W. Kimball were the only ones who knew what was going to happen. And then the president's secretary, in a recent biography, outlines the steps by which President Kimball very carefully brought in first his counselors and then the Quorum of the Twelve into his confidence about this issue, and how he very carefully obtained their approval for this monumental change before he put it to a vote. It's a remarkable story, and it's even more remarkable that a president's secretary put it in print in a Deseret Book publication. And I just was, I applauded as I read that and put it into my book on decision making. But it involved, as did the previous 1969 action and then reversal of that action, it involved differences of view about a fundamental question of church policy, which was also defined as being doctrinal. And even though since the presidency of Spencer W. Kimball, I think it's fair to say that the leadership of the church probably in that period of time since 1973 is more united and has been more united for almost 25 years than it ever was in the previous more than 100 years of the church. And I think that that is not an overstatement. There are still differences of view. And despite their sincere efforts to find unanimity, to find harmony, and even in a period of time when I think they have been more harmonious than they've ever been before, they're still men with conscientious differences and certainly with personality differences, and there are occasional ripples. And I point out some of those that occur right up until 1996 that indicate that there are significant differences of view in decision-making or in attitudes toward doctrine or policy. So, with that, I've given you as much of a background for those of you who've read the book, as well as a introduction of the kinds of things that are in the book for those of you who have not read it. And I'll just thank you for your time. Those of you who want to leave, who have other engagements or things you need to go to, feel free. You won't offend me. And leave at any time you wish to. But for those who want to remain seated, I will, before I open this up to questions and answer, I'll do what I did when I used to conduct seven-hour missionary meetings as a missionary. That was when I had the power to do so. Have you all stand up and stretch a little bit. And then after you sit down or sufficiently stretch, then you're welcome to ask any questions or make comments. If you're making comments, though, make it.
With Moses Thatcher, do you think that Wilford Woodruff came out with a political manifesto as a sort of get-even type of effort after Moses had resisted his ascension to the presidency?
The question relates to Moses Thatcher, who was a member of the Quorum of the Twelve appointed by John Taylor in 1879, and who, with particularly the support of a fellow Democrat, B.H. Roberts, had frequently resisted or challenged the political limits that the first presidency tried to put on Democrats after the adoption of national parties in Utah in 1891. And the question was, do I think that Wilford Woodruff issued the manifesto as a way of punishing Moses Thatcher and by extension, B.H. Roberts, or of pushing them into a box where they were essentially faced with a kind of ultimatum? The political manifesto, which is how it was described at the time in 1896, the bottom line of it is that it said that all presiding officers of the church had to obtain permission before they could accept candidacy for public office, which for a general authority seems a very natural, logical requirement. in that their position and their role as a general authority should take precedence over everything. However, the background to this was that the first presidency had been favoring Republicans and telling Republicans they could go out and campaign and trying to restrain Democrats. And the Democrats felt that this would be implemented in the way that that kind of advice had been before. B.H. Roberts hesitated before signing it, but he did sign it. Moses Thatcher refused to sign it. And it was presented at the April Conference 1896, and because Moses Thatcher refused to sign it, his name was not presented. That would not have been necessarily a permanent change in his position. That has happened to a number of general authorities in the past. It's essentially a very strong warning. But he refused to comply, and this was the problem was intensified by the fact that that Moses Thatcher was addicted to morphine and opium, and that had apparently happened inadvertently because of a lot of health problems he had had. But the fact was that he was an addict, a drug addict, and was at this very same time trying to go through a drug rehabilitation program, and at one time went in cold turkey and nearly died a few months after the manifesto was presented. And in that situation, he was less and less willing to compromise. And the final result was that he was dropped from the Quorum of the Twelve in November and disfellowshipped from the church. And I think the manifesto, the political manifesto, in fact, was a kind of an ultimatum, throwing down the gauntlet. But it had even despite Moses Thatcher, it had to be worked out in principle more flexibly than it stated on its face. And the worst fears of the Democrats ultimately were not fulfilled because there was a certain amount of negotiation that happened, whether it was Democrats or Republicans seeking public office after the issuing of the manifesto. And Moses Thatcher, in many ways, is a tragic casualty, not only of the political ill feeling and conflicts after the division along political lines, but also of drug addiction, because those were two factors that it's hard to separate them from the situation that he found himself in. Yes?
Among the differences among the Quorum of the 12 members today, do you have any reason to think or hope that there are any members of the Quorum of the 12 who are friendly toward women and or gays?
The question is, do I have reason to think that there are any members of the Quorum of the Twelve, despite their differences and despite their unanimity, would there be any members in the Twelve who are friendly toward women and friendly toward gays? On the first part of the question, I must say I think that all of those 12 men would find that question offensive, because they would say, "We're married. We have daughters. Of course we're friendly toward women." And they don't perceive what's behind that question. They don't perceive the sense of denigration that many women in the church feel. And I would say that there are general authorities who have higher levels of sensitivity to the women's issue and do not feel defensive. There are some who are sensitive to it, but they're sensitive in a defensive way. My sense is, if I name them, I'm not going to name them, because if I name them, then they're less inclined to do what they can to manifest that sympathy. But by my personal awareness of three members of the 12, I think that there are three who are particularly sensitive. There are more than that who I think are politically astute, who may not feel the personal pain that empathetically that I think the other three who are junior may feel, but who are politically astute about what this means for the institution. And so I think that there's almost a half there who either is a combination of political astuteness or personal empathy, if they had their druthers, there would be changes and greater evidences institutionally of sympathy. But again, this requires unanimous voting, and the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, who I don't mind naming, Boyd K. Packer, has not shown a great deal of willingness to be sensitive to the issues of women in the church, as although he would be offended by my saying that, and I'm sure his wife would be as well. But I think that nonetheless is true. Concerning gays and lesbians, there's a personal dimension to that. There is one member of the Quorum of the Twelve whom I understand has a son who is openly gay, not living in Utah. And I do not want to speak of that family by name. But that member of the Twelve has given some of the most unkind, in my view, statements about publicly about gay and lesbian issues. And I don't know whether that is by assignment or whether that is a manifestation of this father's own homophobia, but either way, it's tragic. It's a personal tragedy within the family, but it certainly is tragic as a greater drumbeat of self-hatred that is communicated to a fairly significant segment of men and women in the church. I don't see anyone who I could identify as an advocate, except those same three that I mentioned, who I think at a personal level are empathetic toward the feelings of dismissal that women have in the church, the feelings of denigration. Those are also empathetic toward all people's human experience, and therefore not for any special reason except that they are empathetic toward the human condition. They are also sympathetic to gay and lesbian issues. But again, it takes unanimous decision-making, and these people are not at the top. Yes?
Now, when Bruce McConkie was telling about the meeting in the temple at which the 1978 revelation was proposed, he mentioned that there were 10 of the 12 apostles who were there. And I had heard that Mark Peterson was out of the country on assignment. Who were the two that were not there?
As I remember, it was Marky Peterson and Delbert Stapley, both of whom were senior in the 12. Not the most senior, but they were senior members. And I don't make a big emphasis about this because it's... the reason I don't is that the discussions within the Quorum of the Twelve had been going on for months. And had they been going on only in the period during the 2 weeks or so that these two men were not available for temple meetings, then I would have felt more justification in discussing the significance of their not being there, as I did with the manifesto. However, because these discussions had been going on for months, as far as I could assume, Marky Peterson was aware of the discussions that President Kimball had conducted. And therefore, I didn't perceive that as much of a coup d'etat administratively in decision-making, in decision-making way, as I did the Manifesto of 1890. But it is certainly clear, and it certainly is an interesting coincidence, that a Marky Peterson, who was on record not only in favor of the priesthood restriction, but was also stridently in favor of social segregation of African Americans in American society, it's interesting that he was not included in that meeting. But again, since it had been a matter of discussion for some months, I'm not sure that is as significant as it would have been. The evidence I have from the accounts of those June events, though, were that the meeting was held, the prayer meeting was held, the decision was made, and the statement was prepared before the telegram went to Marky Peterson informing him of what had already been done. So his vote was not solicited in June 1978. Yes, toward the back. Yes, in the middle back. Yes. You need to stand.
Talking about political or differences of feelings among the general authorities, are there manifestations of their political differences in, as far as policy, as far as general positions or things of this kind?
Okay, so you're talking about political in a partisan political sense. The question is, in view of the my comments about differences of view between the general authorities, do those differences include partisan political differences? And I spend a fair amount of time discussing that in two chapters in the book. There's one chapter where I look at Ezra Taft Benson as a case study of political controversy involving several quorums. And then in the partisan politics chapter, that is a theme that runs throughout it, how there was so much controversy within quorums and between quorums over political issues from the 1890s up to the 1950s in particular. The period since 1973 is a different kind of situation. And the tail end of the Ezra Taft Benson chapter talks about how he really became the lone example of partisan conflict within the hierarchy during those years. And the degree of harmony that President Kimball was able to build out of just a true sense of love and expression of love has continued as a heritage, and that each new president has sought to emulate that kind of harmony that he brought, because quite frankly, prior to his presidency, there had been a lot of division within the hierarchy, and he changed that in such a dramatic way that the hierarchy has never wanted to go back to what I describe occurring in that chapter on Ezra Taft Benson. Because one of the remarkable things about that controversy is how public it was. Those on various sides of it had no hesitation in expressing their critical views about other members of the hierarchy to other members of the church, rank and file, to non-members of the church, to newspaper reporters. In many ways, it became a media circus, which was certainly something that representatives of the media were happy about. But Mormons of various political points of view, I think, were distraught at the level of animosity and disagreement that was appearing in the newspapers from 1962 to 1980 over political issues. And Ezra Taft Benson was the center of it. But since that time, once he became president of the church, he became president of the church as an ultra-conservative during the Reagan administration. And there were no external battles for him to fight, and the hierarchy, after the death of its well-known liberals, is conservative. Some more conservative than others, but you don't have any ones who are known as social political liberals, as was N. Eldon Tanner, although very moderate in his way of expressing it, and certainly not like a Hubie Brown. So it's a different kind of framework for the men that allows them to be perfectly honest in their political views and yet have no dramatic conflicts, because they are basically of one mind in political and social issues. Although there are certain amounts of variability, those occur within a very conservative framework. It's not like it was in the 1960s. Yes? Okay, there's a kind of a two-pronged question here involving phrase the cult of the brethren, and one side of it is in relation to the question of infallibility and decision making. The other side of it is the idea that the highest leaders of the church are in frequent contact, either in appearance or by vision, with Jesus. And what I comment on that was a comment on one side of that, and that is this, what I use the term charisma, which in sociology and history of religion includes what Mormons refer to as visionary witness. but it includes, it's a secular term that includes all of the ways that we think and we words we use to define revelation between God and man, including vision, word for word revelation, whisperings of the Spirit. That charisma is the term that kind of is the umbrella for that. And I talk about how the charisma in the 20th century hierarchy is different, dramatically different from that in the 19th century hierarchy. And the most dramatic difference is that when an apostle was ordained in the 19th century, the apostle was given a charge, as the apostles are today. That charge in the 19th century was based almost verbatim on the charge the apostles gave, or rather the apostles received in 1835 from Oliver Cowdery. And one phrase of that charge was quoted verbatim to new apostles in the 19th century, and it was, "Never cease striving until you have seen God face to face." Now, ordination to the apostleship never required a previous vision. But in the 19th century, a new apostle was given a lifelong obligation to seek visionary witness, to seek to become, in actual fact, a special witness of Jesus Christ by vision or by appearance. It was a lifelong obligation, no matter what his visionary or spiritual experiences had been prior to accepting the obligation of apostle. What I found from the diaries and autobiographies of the apostles in the 20th century is that the charge changed in two ways. First, there was no longer in the 20th century an obligation to obtain a visionary witness. And that obligation for obtaining a visionary witness was replaced by an obligation to join in unanimous decision-making by the Quorum of the Twelve. Two very significant changes, I think, in the charge, which defines the Quorum of the Twelve in particular in a very different way from what it was understood to involve in the 19th century. And then I talk about that the change in the charge or the obligation of being a special witness has also been communicated publicly by redefinition of what it means to be a special witness of Jesus Christ. And I trace this. So my short-term answer to your question on this one issue is that visionary witness, communicating with God face-to-face in the Quorum of the Twelve in particular, is less emphasized than it was in the 19th century, and less experienced than it was in the 19th century. On the issue of the adoration of the brethren, or the I use the term adoration of the prophet, I talk about this in the political chapter because it emerges with clear political consequences in the 1960s, and I talk about that there. The short version is that in the 19th century, the members of the church were, if anything, discouraged from idolizing or adoring the president of the church. In the 20th century, particularly since the presidency of David O. McKay, there has become a cult of personality, which is a political science term. Sociologically, it's called institutionalized awe within Mormon culture. And I trace that, the steps of that. And because I chose to read every issue of the Church News from 1931 to 1996 to find what was important enough in Mormon society to end up there, I found that I could trace this in a very clear manner through the headlines of the Church News. And what I found was that from 1931 to the mid-1960s, the church president only on one occasion was ever referred to as the prophet. It was always president or mister, but usually president. Prophet was used exclusively to refer to an Old Testament prophets or to Book of Mormon prophets. It was not used as a title for the current president of the church. It was used most often to refer to Joseph Smith. And so when you had a reference to the prophet, your chances on a guess were more than 50% that it is referring to Joseph Smith. In 1960s, that changed. And I explain the political significance of how that changed. But it becomes a dramatic change in a space of a very short time. The church news goes from having no headlines referring to the president of the church as the prophet to almost every issue having at least one headline reference to him as the prophet. And that has clear, and I demonstrate how it has clear political consequences. Back in the previous time, it was pretty easy for members of the church to dissent politically from the president of the church when they weren't being encouraged to idolize him. Ever since the 1960s, it has been very difficult for members of the church to politically dissent from the political views expressed by the president of the church when there is this encouragement for adulation. And I comment on it, and I think in a very telling way from, at least to me it's telling, significant, from Gordon B. Hinckley's most recent biography, the official biography by Sherry Dew, which drew on his diaries. In that biography, he comments about this, and he says, "Adulation is poison," which is a wonderful phrase. And it indicates his view of what I see as a problem of adoring the church president, because it leads toward feelings of infallibility. And Catholic infallibility, we misuse the term. The Catholic doctrine of infallibility is not that the Pope is without flaw. It is that the Pope can never make a mistake in statements that he makes formally about matters of faith or doctrine. Now, how is that different from what Sunday school lessons, what conference talks, what Relief Society lessons, what seminary lessons are saying now about the church leaders? M. Russell Ballard, twice, has said to general conferences, BYU students, firesides to 20,000 BYU students, we will not lead you astray. We cannot. So it's not just the president of the church who's infallible. It's all of them. And they would say, oh, we don't claim infallibility. We're human. We can make mistakes. In matters of faith or morals, can you make a statement that is contrary to what is God's will? Can you make a mistake in a matter of church policy? And if they say no, then that is the doctrine of Catholic infallibility. That's what infallibility means. The personal side of that said, adulation is poison. Yet his biography is a living symbol that there are those at church headquarters who are determined to institutionalize the adulation of the president of the church. You look at the last photograph of the illustrations in Gordon B. Hinckley's biography where this statement appears. And that last photograph is President Hinckley and his wife in a garden kind of setting, and you look at them, and the photograph has been created in such a manner that there seems to be a light emanating as halos from their heads. Now, we're looking at a visual representation of adulation, even deification, and that comes in a book that, where he himself, at a personal level, says adulation is poison. But obviously, others at church headquarters don't think adulation is poison. They think it is the way to obtain obedience, and that has certainly been the case, I think, in the Mormon experience. So I do discuss these issues, and I come down. I'm preaching to the converted here, probably, but I see these as problems. The appeal to infallibility is a problem in any organization that is staffed by humans. It is not a problem in an organization that is not staffed by humans. But in an organization that is staffed by humans, any appeal to infallibility creates a kind of sand trap of faith, that somebody is going to stumble into that when they discover that, yes, the leadership of the church, even at the highest level, can make mistakes in policies or whatever, in pronouncements regarding faith and morals. No matter how narrowly or how widely you define faith and morals, those things have occurred. Yes. Okay, a multiple part question, but relating to how I see the directions of the LDS Church going in terms of, quote, liberal issues such as the ordination of women, greater acceptance of diversity, questions of academic freedom or intellectual inquiry, whatever. The bottom line is I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel, and this, of course, presupposes that I think Mormonism is in a tunnel, and I do. But I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel, and unfortunately, I don't see it as generational. It is a worldview. It is an attitude toward diversity. It is an attitude toward conformity that goes beyond age. I'll give you an example of students. I was mentioning this at the dinner table. My students at BYU. I gave, as a part of an introductory set of two presentations on the meaning of history, the role of history, I gave this slide presentation and commentary that had been produced by a national educational organization. And as a part of that, I distributed an exam that was an attitude exam. And it related to the issues that these presentations gave about cultural diversity, about problems in Africa and Northern Ireland. I mean, there were a lot of issues that were being presented, political, social, dealt with imperialism, dealt with colonialism, dealt with issues of conscience and issues of war and dispute. Well, one of the questions, when I first started giving the exam, one of the questions, and it was not mine, it was produced by this national organization, the question was set up as a true-false with the explanation that even if you feel that the answer could be both true and false, or yes and no, give the answer that seems closest to you, or that would apply in most cases. One of the questions was, true or false, yes or no, social order is more important than individual conscience. When I first began teaching of the courses that I had involving approximately 150 students, results were that about 10% of the students answered yes on that question, that social order is more important than individual conscience. By the time I left BYU in 1988, 12 years later, when I gave that, the results of that same presentation, same questions, nothing had changed, 90% of my students were answering yes to the question that social order is more important than individual conscience. It is not an issue of generational change. You cannot expect that a few funerals are going to bring about the church that you would hope there to be. It is an attitude issue that I think is as deep, if not even more fanatically held by young people than it is by the leaders that you identify as those who have old-fashioned or benighted or whatever negative term you might feel about these attitudes, which I share. I share that assessment. But I do not share any hope that this is going to change in the near future. I see Mormonism in a dark age, and I do not see the dark ages of Mormonism changing in my lifetime. However, things can change dramatically, and I gave two examples of them, through the decision of the president of the church. And the president of the church in the past, and I gave those two dramatic examples, can do something totally unexpected that no one under the circumstances would expect the president to do. That is possible. But in terms of my perceptions of things and my perceptions of the dynamics of leadership, I don't expect there to be any change. And even if I did, I don't have the willpower or the courage to be a social activist. I admire those. And when I use the term social activist, this is not in any kind of condescending way. I admire social activists. I have benefited dramatically in my lifetime from social activism, but I do not have the courage, the guts to be a social activist, even if I thought it could bring about change in Mormonism. So I've had enough on my plate just being a historian. Yes? All right, the question is for those of listening to a tape. How do individual general authorities who have a very strong point of view make that church policy, and how do they obtain the unanimous consent, which is required, of other general authorities who may not feel the same kind of urgency?
Actually, and for such a decision, would the unanimous consent be required? Okay, to forbid somebody to speak on it.
And in all decisions, would unanimous vote, like for example, if there is a policy that a certain source is not to be used in a general conference talk, such as the King Follett Discourse, does that kind of decision require a unanimous vote? I'll speak to the larger question, and that is, how can an individual general authority who feels very strongly about a point of view, how can he obtain a consensus, even a unanimous vote, to support that point of view from those who may not share his feeling of urgency or may not agree with him? I'll give an example in two directions. One is that the general authority may just quietly bide his time until he becomes senior or until the deaths of those who were in opposition to him on a particular issue allow for either a large consensus or a unanimous point of view. And when I say, wait, they have these open discussions on a variety of issues, and so it's very easy for them to understand where other members of their quorum are on particular issues, even before they come up to a vote. That's one way. Another is the squeaky wheel issue. And that is that even a junior member of the 12, if he is adamant, if he is combative, if he is persistent, can obtain, despite his junior position in seniority, junior members of the 12 who simply want an end to the squeaky wheel or combative kind of argument. And I'll give you, without citing anyone by name, and in fact it wasn't cited by name, I was in a discussion with Howard W. Hunter when he was a senior member of the 12 in his office. I came simply to thank him for the role that he had played in the publication of the biography of J. Reuben Clark. And it had been published while I was in Europe, and I came back that summer and thanked him for the role that he had in that. And he invited me to just sit and chat with him, and we did for about an hour, hour and a half. And he had in his room at that point, or in his office at that point, he had a scale model of the Jerusalem Center, which he eventually dedicated. And he told me of his hope and his urging the Quorum of the Twelve for a number of years that this center should reach out to Muslims and to Arabs as equally as it did to Jews. And that he was concerned that the church not be perceived in the Middle East as being pro-Zionist and or pro-Israeli. And of course there are Israelis who are Muslims, and most of the Palestinians who live on the West Bank are Christians, in fact. So we're talking about a variety of religious points of view. But he wanted to reach out to the Arab peoples, whether they were Christian or Muslim. And he commented at the time that in the Quorum of the Twelve, there were some very strident members of the Twelve who were junior, who were pro-Zionist. And he said, and he didn't name any names, so I'm not holding back anything that he didn't, you know, that he did say to me. But he said, you know, when one of these individuals speaks up in the Quorum of the Twelve and is so emphatic about his point of view, I just stay quiet. I don't say anything, because I don't want to turn a temple council into a catfight. And That's one reality. And as I was with him, and for 15 minutes afterwards, I was just filled with a sense of awe that brought me nearly to tears about how Christ-like he was. And what a wonderful attitude this was. And then it hit me. This is a disaster, administratively. Because what it means is all that somebody has to do is be obnoxious. And the more quiet, loving, non-combative senior members of the 12 won't speak up. And a junior member who is belligerent or, I hate to use value terms, but they apply, that somebody who's combative can obtain something far beyond what his seniority would lead you to believe that he could. So that's one way. The other way is that there are certain administrative decisions that are made in such a way that they're not considered important enough to require a quorum decision. And those vary from time to time, and whether it's music that's sung in church or whatever, there may be one general authority who doesn't want to have anything but hymns sung in church. And for a period of time, he may persuade other members of the 12 or even other general authorities in other quorums, like the 70s, to say that, give that same message out in conferences they attend. But that doesn't mean that message has gone for a vote for the quorum of the 12 as a whole or for his presidency. If that eventually ends up in the church news or the priesthood bulletin, yes, then it's obvious that this has been submitted for a formal vote. But sometimes there are things that can be handled by a person who has very strong views, and it can have very significant administrative impact, but has not come up for a formal vote of the 12. And when the formal vote comes, sometimes that may reverse that position, or it may affirm it. But the hierarchy is not a monolith. It is a hierarchy, but it is not a monolith. And there are many things that occur by power of bureaucrats, by power of secretaries, who I define as part of the bureaucracy, that don't always involve quorum votes. And so you have a variety of in the policymaking and administrative life of Mormonism. And that extends even down to the local level. You know that local bishops can ignore specific provisions in the General Handbook of Instructions. And generally, I find liberals applaud those when it applies to a liberal agenda, but are appalled by it when a local leader ignores or creates a new than is in the General Handbook of Instructions. So many of these decisions, whether you regard them as good things or bad things, really depends on where you are in your own political, philosophical, theological point of view. And to the degree that I can, in what I presented in my study of the hierarchy, I don't make those kinds of value judgments. I do my best to say, this is what happened, this is what I understand, what is what happened, but you may applaud it, you may bemoan it, but I just do my best to present it and not tell you what to think about this. This is an approach that I consciously adopted in the J. Reuben Clark biography, and it was really quite thrilling to me to people who had hated him for decades said, you gave me more reasons to hate that man. And people who had loved him, including members of his own family, said, oh, you've given me so much more to understand about what a wonderful man he was. And I just felt that I had done everything to do because I presented him in his terms without telling the reader what to think. And readers come to their own conclusions. Yes?
One final question.
All right, yes. All right, I will be as blunt as I can be on that issue. The question is, how would I characterize Boyd K. Packer as an administrator? I think Boyd K. Packer is mean-spirited. He is the most malignant influence I am aware of in contemporary Mormon decision-making and administration. He enjoys hurting people. He is vindictive. But he is conscientious in the sense that
he feels that people who do not see the church as he sees it are wrong, unalterably wrong, and that if they will not conform to his point of view, then they are expendable. I find that, frankly, reprehensible in a leader that I regard as a prophet, seer, and revelator. However, promising to be frank as I am, I regard him as a prophet, seer, and revelator. And I sustain him. If I could vote in a meeting in which his name were presented, I would present my arm to the square in voting yes. I do sustain him in that position. But I regard him as a person that I find in many ways a person that I would not want to spend much time with. And he's, I'm sure, convinced that I won't have to. So with that, thank you very much.